This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
This is another podcast of Worldwide Wave, the international LGBT news and current affairs show, every week on Australia's first LGBT radio station, Joy 94.9.
Surfing the globe, bringing you news, views, and current affairs for the LGBT community, this is the Worldwide Wave.
It's the show that takes you around the globe one country at a time. Worldwide Wave, Joy's international news and current affairs show for and by the LGBTI community. My name's Matt, and with me tonight on Worldwide Wave is Stefan. Welcome back.
Thank you. Good evening.
Good to have you back on deck.
Good to be here. We Australians think we punch above our weight in the world, and just look at the per capita medal tally at the Olympics we crow about. But we can be especially proud when we lead the world in a health crisis. Now, we're not talking about coronavirus. We're talking about the fight against HIV and AIDS.
What began as a book to chronicle the history of a queer community organisation, ACON, has turned into a powerful, gritty story of survival. The fights, the heroes, and the personal stories that became our world-leading response to HIV and AIDS in the 1980s and 90s. Our guest tonight is the author of the book, Fighting for Our Lives, Nick Cook, and here's a taste of what's coming up.
It's not just a lovely, you know, oh, here we all came together and held hands, wasn't it nice? No. I get into the shit fights as well, and there are a lot of them. It gets very political, it gets very nasty, it got very full on. And I don't blame them for that at all. You know, this isn't the board of a bowling club arguing about maintenance of the green. Everybody knew, as they tried to figure out a way that they could work together, that the stakes could not possibly be any higher. They knew as they sat there, if we get this wrong, we are probably going to die and our community is probably going to be destroyed.
Australia's gay community was finding its place in the early 1980s. And then a mysterious disease struck. Gay men were dying in staggering numbers around the world, and Sydney was Australia's epicentre for AIDS. Some listeners will have vivid and permanent memories of Australia during the AIDS crisis, while others will have limited understanding. Australia's AIDS fight, universally acknowledged as world-leading, has been documented in a new book titled Fighting for Our Lives. We ask the author, Nick Cook, to paint us a picture of gay life in Australia in the 1980s.
Well, I'm not exactly the best person to speak about that, to be honest, and that was a big part of what got me into this project. I'm 35, I came along just at the very end of it. I was hitting puberty, where they found the drug that stopped it from being a fatal disease, and it became a manageable condition. And from there on, it just sort of disappeared into the background. So by the time I was on Oxford Street, we just weren't talking about it. And I'm not just talking about me and my friends. I mean, all of my older friends, people who I've since discovered, were very much in the centre of the crisis. Just don't talk about it. And the more I learned about it, the more I got to know about it, the more ashamed I was of how little I knew. And I realized that this is sort of one of the things that got me into this, that this is a story that we are in danger of forgetting, and it's a story that must never, ever be forgotten. But certainly speaking from what I know now of how it went, I can't imagine it. I just cannot. To the people who are listening that were there, my heart goes out to you. I cannot comprehend what it was like to live through that, to see the wheelchairs up and down Oxford Street, to watch your friends wasting away, to have those awful evening sessions where you would go and help your friend take the pills to die because there was just absolutely no joy left in life. It was, I cannot wrap my head around it. It must have been horrendous. And also, and again, well, AIDS itself was not something I knew a lot about. To learn just how horrendous this disease is, you know, nobody ever actually dies from AIDS. it's always an AIDS-related illness. It destroys your immune system and leaves you open to, well, everything else. So it is just one infection after another until your body can't take it anymore and just, you just, I spent a lot of nights, more than a few times, I would go to bed in tears. It was very, very hard to look at this, see this, how it was happening. But in terms of the actual reality of it, I don't know how you could possibly get a real sense of it. We need to try as hard as we possibly can, but no, I'll never pretend that I've walked in those shoes. I don't know how they ever did it.
There was also, I mean, the stigma, there's still stigma around today. It was a different kind of stigma back then when you talked about AIDS-related illnesses where people would say, you know, they've got other things. You know, mentioning that you had AIDS just wasn't done.
Oh, no. Well, it started from a... Well, I mean, look at coronavirus and, you know, people avoiding Asians and all kinds of silly things going on now. And that's a faint shadow of what AIDS was, of what HIV was. And it's just... It was starting from a very low base, too. I mean, in 1980s Australia, you would be very hard-pressed to find any three groups of people in society who were more stigmatised than gay men, sex workers, and people who inject drugs. They were the fags, the whores, and the junkies. You know, this was words actually used in Parliament, of all places. It was disgusting the way that they were already being treated. And then this illness comes along that targets them, that seems to have originated from them. It just ratcheted up that hysteria to a ridiculous degree. So you had talk of actually quarantining them. There was talk of just, you know, fencing off North Head and putting them all up there, doing all kinds of awful things. There were people with escape plans ready to get out of Sydney as quickly as possible if they actually did start trying to round people up. And it's very lucky that we had such sensible politicians. It was never seriously considered. But there was and I forget the exact figures, but the polls were ridiculous. You know, more than half of people saying that we should quarantine them. All kinds of silly things like that.
You've caught my attention there. You mentioned the word sensible and politicians in the same sentence. It is one of the things that set Australia's response apart, that there were some sensible politicians in the right place at the right time. Tell us about that.
Oh, absolutely. There are three elements that make Australia's response so good. And each of these three elements existed to some extent in other places. What made Australia the world leader? We were the only place in the world where they all worked together so perfectly. Now, the first was the politicians. We were very lucky to have the Hawke government had just come in, and we had Neil Blewett as the minister. And on the other side of the aisle, and on the other side of the chamber, we had Peter Baum, and he was the shadow minister, and he was one of the very much a liberal, like an actual liberal, not a conservative at all. And between them, they created a bipartisan policy that was groundbreaking. It was absolutely brilliant in what it did. It was, we are going to do this sensibly. We are going to do this without any politics. Because both of them could very clearly see that if you start playing politics like this, in the way that happened with Reagan and with Thatcher and in all kinds of places in the world, if you start playing politics with this, who can be toughest on AIDS? Who can do the best to get rid of this scourge of society? By which they mean the people who carry the virus more than the virus itself. Then there is no winner. You are looking at a humanitarian disaster. So the politicians did brilliantly.
That's not a line you hear very often. That's Nick Cook, the author of the book Fighting for Our Lives, joining us here on Joy 94.9. The other thing that just grabbed my attention is he was talking about, you know, people wanted to be quarantined at North Head, and I just went straight to Christmas Island, coronavirus. You know, there's so many parallels to where we are today.
Yeah, I mean, at the time, the transmission mode wasn't really established.
Understand.
People didn't understand it. We didn't know how it was transmitted, so that's why there was quite a lot of measures put into place to to try uncertain transmission mode is described as in the books that talk about that. Whilst we for corona for the latest, we kind of know how it's transmitted, so it's
more.
a little bit different. But yes,
but
that's what we want to do. We want to isolate these people when we don't know what, and then the stigma comes from all that. I think.
Coming up, we hear some of the people and their stories that defined Australia's fight against HIV and AIDS in the 1980s. You're on World Wide Wave.
Love radio? Joy is now on iHeartRadio. Take us with you anywhere.
Hi, my name is Kenneth. I'm from LGB Denmark. You're hearing me on the World Wide Wave.
We've had a message in as well. Thanks, Melina. Good to hear from you. Fantastic interview. The comparisons with the AIDS stigma is a fantastic example to today's fear with other groups, yes. Oh, a question. Why are there gay politicians who forgot the struggles of persecuted minorities in the past and want to vilify under the guise of freedom of speech? I think I know who you're referring to. I think that's one of Nick's essential messages there, though, that we cannot forget. We cannot forget. We can't let new generations come through and not know what the fight that took place before them.
Yeah, it's difficult, though, because I think when things get better and there's better treatment, then you kind of seem to start
things
to forget
move on.
The fight. Mm. Things move on, yeah.
What do you remember from those days of the early days, the 80s and 90s, in Australia? It might be about HIV/AIDS. What was Melbourne like? What did you think of Sydney and its gay scene back then? Nick Cook is our guest tonight. He has gathered the stories of Australia's early response to the AIDS crisis in his book titled Fighting for Our Lives. He's just been explaining the progress made by politicians when both the health minister and his opposition counterpart agreed on a bipartisan approach. Nick also calls out Australia's doctors for their tremendous effort.
Then, of course, there are the doctors, who again did very well. And again, one of the places we were very much quicker to start dealing with this properly was in our hospitals. We had a bit of trouble at first, but there was a bit of difficulty in the early days. I mean, nurses would be very hesitant to go into the same room as people with HIV, meals being left in the corridor. We had all that awfulness as elsewhere, but we got over it much quicker than others. But what the third element, and the one that really made ours special, was the community. And this is the part of it that I focus on most in the book, because the other two stories have been told, and they deserve their place in the history. But what really made it special, the glue that bound all of it together, were the community people on the ground, the people like Don Baxter and Lex Watson and Bill Whittaker and Ross Duffin, who's down in Melbourne now. Actually, he's down your way. These people who were able to do this was they were the glue that bound it all together, but more than that, they were the fuel that kept it going. When the politicians were starting to get a bit nervous about the polls, saying, you know, nobody likes us doing all of these things to help these deviant kind of people, when the doctors were getting a bit slow, when they weren't trying hard enough, when they weren't pushing hard enough to get the drugs through the approval system, it was the people on the ground, the protesters, the people like ACT UP with Bruce Brown and whatnot, who were in there. One day, they went to Parliament House, the new Parliament House, which hadn't long been opened. Bruce Brown and a whole bunch of ACT UP people. I believe Lyle Chan was there as well. I might be wrong on that. But a whole bunch of these ACT UP people went there on June 6, 1991, and they went into the public gallery above the chamber during question time. And just as Bob Hawke was answering a question that he was very proud of himself for, they erupted in chanting and protesting. And by then, the health minister was Brian Howe, and it was AIDS drug now, Brian Howe. And two of them went leaping down the aisle and jumped over the barrier from the public gallery about 6 or 8 metres, some incredible distance, down to the floor of the Parliament House. They'd never seen anything like it before. I mean, this is the kind of bravery and courage and drama we're talking about. It was an intense time.
It's fair to say that, I mean, you mentioned ACT UP. It's fair to say that the community wasn't always on the same page. There were a lot of people who didn't like the tactics of ACT UP and, thought there was a different way, a calmer way perhaps to approach public policy.
Well, I'm very pleased you say that, because I am to some extent, one of them. I look at what happened. I look at ACT UP. From what I've read, what I've done, I look at it and think, was that the best way to go about it? Sure, it got attention, but how did it get you on any? Did it get anybody on your side? But you cannot. I'll tell you one thing: I do not ever question their bravery and their courage and their commitment and their. And I don't really blame them for being that angry. But here's the important thing, and I keep thinking about this more and more. I'm not convinced that everything they did was in the best interest. But do you know what? I have not found a single person from that generation, even some of the people they attacked, even the people like John Baxter and Ann Malcolm, who were viciously attacked by ACT UP at various stages, I can't even get them to agree with me. So academically, yes, I agree with you fully. From what I've read, from what I've learned, I do have those doubts. I think, that certainly wouldn't work today. And even at the time, I wonder if there must have been a better way. But I guess if you were there in the moment at the time, even the people that they were abusing do not hold a grudge against them for it.
That's, I guess, the activism side of things, but there was an incredible mobilising of care as well. And I'm thinking Ann Carley, the Bobby Goldsmith Foundation, the starting of the group that is now People Living with HIV and AIDS. Tell us a bit about that grassroots response to looking after people with HIV and AIDS.
That's one of the special parts of it, the really special parts of it, because the doctors and nurses in the very early stages were not great at this. And I'm talking the really kind of early, like, you know, 82, 83, even in the start of 84. It was pretty bad. You know, the meal trays were being left in the corridor. The nurses were too scared to go near them. Surgeons were refusing to do surgery. There were all kinds of awful things going on. And also, of course, there was absolutely no treatment. I mean, there was just no effective treatment until AZT about 1988. So there was nothing really could be done anyway, except treat the infections as the various infections and ailments as they came up. But the gay community very quickly realised that hospitals are not the best place for these people, these poor suffering people. And so at a time when they didn't know how this was being passed on, they didn't know what the risks were, they didn't know anything at all, they formed together and they began looking after each other. And it's just one of the most remarkable community building things that ever has happened to the gay community. Everybody talks about Mardi Gras as sort of, you know, the moment where the gay community came together. And that's true. That's certainly true. That's where they came together and said, we are going to fight for our rights. But in those early years of the 80s, when the Bobby Goldsmith Foundation was formed and CSN, Community Support Network, and all the various ones, that is when they were bound together because they weren't just fighting for their rights anymore. They were really fighting for their lives.
Which is hence the title of the book, Fighting for Our Lives. Nick Cook there is the author. You're on Joy 94.9. It's a shame that it takes tragedies sometimes for such a mobilisation, but a good thing that it has happened, though, particularly those community groups. You know, I certainly, my memories of that time, there were a lot of groups, even like there's a lot of LGBT groups around today, but back then as well. We have had a message in that your memories from the 80s, the very controversial Grim Reaper. Thanks, 317. Absolutely. The Grim Reaper ad, which is, you know, I'm sort of in the marketing game, it is still held as one of the most remembered ad campaigns. It only ran for less than 2 weeks.
Is it remembered because it was powerful, or is it remembered for what is it remembered?
So all of the above. It was a very powerful message. It was the first time. So at the start of the AIDS crisis, there was a lot of talk about it. It was all a gay disease, and this was the first time they showed little children. They showed women. They showed all sorts of people on the screen, and just the imagery of it was so so simple and so powerful. Mm. and it created such furor.
So, but did it create awareness, and yes. Or did it stigmatise?
There was no escape. No, there was. I think there
because was, I wasn't in Australia at this time, obviously.
I think it went both ways. There were certainly people who didn't like it, and that's why it was taken off air. But it started a conversation. I think that was the thing that really made it serious for people to think, you know, this needs to be addressed. We've got more coming up from our guest Nick Cook, author of the book Fighting for Our Lives.
Turn us on and we'll turn it out. Joy.
Hi, this is Costa Gavrilidis, the president of Accept LGBT Cyprus, and you're on the World Wide Wave.
Some more messages. Thank you, 317. Maybe it's time to do an adaptation of Angels in America for the 2020, for this year, for a younger generation with Australian artists. That's a good idea. Wonder if they would get it. So, and Rent as well. Rent was a great musical. And
I don't know what Angels in America is.
Angels in America was a HBO TV show. Again, very powerful storyline around HIV and AIDS. Not quite sure how to take this on. I think sadly some, this is 317, I think sadly some middle-class gay men have become too complacent, successful to remember the past and want to assimilate. Ooh, that's harsh.
It is harsh. I don't know. I don't know what to think about this.
Is it assimilation or is it just that?
I don't know that it is assimilation. I don't know what to say, actually.
Melina's sent us an email about the Grim Reaper ad. It's a link to an article where the guy who created it said he's incredibly proud, and it's an ad that has never been equaled for its shock value and how it drove the conversation there. So thanks for that, Melina. We are, of course, talking tonight about Australia's fight against HIV and AIDS. It was a group effort, and it was led by ACON, the AIDS Council of New South Wales. A new book by Nick Cook called Fighting for Our Lives was also a history of ACON, or at least that's how it began.
At the very beginning, it was going to be just a history of ACON. That was sort of our original goal. But it wasn't very far into it that I realised, no, there's a far bigger story here that hasn't been told of Bobby Goldsmith Foundation and CSN and PLWHA and ACT UP. These stories haven't been told. So sort of ACON had to move over quite a bit to make room for them as well. And it became a much larger story about the community response in general.
So you've done a lot of research, you've spoken to a lot of people. What have you learned about the people who were at the forefront of this fight and I guess how it might have set us up for future fights?
Probably the biggest lesson that's been learned, and I feel that it has been learned to some extent by healthcare. This is when healthcare changed entirely. The biggest lesson is that you need to involve the affected communities in what you are doing. Before this, it was very much the doctors would tell you what to do and you would go and do it. And there was actually quite a fight with the doctors' organisations for the gay people to get a place at the table. And they had to fight very hard to get there because, you know, the doctors were not used to dealing with patient groups in this way, whereas the affected communities, the gay men in particular, people like Lex Watson were banging the table and essentially saying to them, to the doctors and the politicians, no, get stuffed. You are not going to tell us what to do. To the doctors, you know, only a decade or so ago, you thought we were all mentally ill. You were trying to cure us. And to the politicians saying, you know, there's still a lot of places in the country where you still think we're criminals. I am not going to listen to you. You are going to listen to me. If we're going to do this, we're going to do it together. And to be honest, I do feel like that lesson's been learned. I mean, I've done quite a bit of journalism and whatnot, and I didn't realise this is where it came from, but certainly I can see, like in the Indigenous communities, this is how they try and do it there as well. And with any other group that you deal with, and of course, well, ACON Eve today is still doing much of the same thing. The health department wouldn't dream of putting out any kind of initiative directly targeted at gay men without first speaking to ACON. So that's probably the most important one, I think, to have come out of it. You've got to involve people and you've got to speak to them in their own language. But also, I think probably another big lesson is that the communities have to come together. They have to be able to work together. I mean, if I don't know if you've had a chance to read the book yet, but it's very dramatic in terms of its I don't shy away from charting. It's not just a lovely, you know, oh, here we all came together and held hands, wasn't it nice? No. I get into the shit fights as well, and there are a lot of them. It gets very political. It gets very nasty. It got very full on. And I don't blame them for that at all, because this isn't the board arguing about, you know, this isn't the board of a bowling club arguing about maintenance of the green. Everybody knew, as they tried to figure out a way that they could work together, that the stakes could not possibly be any higher. They knew as they sat there, if we get this wrong, we are probably going to die and our community is probably going to be destroyed. We need to get this right. So, of course, the emotions and the tensions were high.
It's a remarkable history from a time when Australia led the world in the response to HIV and AIDS. The book is Fighting for Our Lives. The author is Nick Cook. Nick, thanks for taking the time to chat to us.
Thank you very much.
Now, Stefan, you have a non-Australian experience of that time period. What's your recollection?
Yeah,
of
well, I did some volunteering in HIV organisation at the time, and then worked with for them. But it was very, very different the way that, I mean, there was no coordinated action. It was very difficult to start some needle exchange programs, because you had to have a prescription to buy needles and syringes in pharmacy, and they were the only places you could legally obtain them. So
Whereas here in Australia, that was one of another one of the defining features of Australia's response was that injecting drug users did not. There was no spike in HIV transmission. There were free needles. Yeah. It was quite well handled.
So there was a massive spike in France, for example, or in countries like Spain as well, and not so much Portugal somehow. Condoms were very difficult as well because of the underlying Catholic church power.
Wow.
So it was very, very different.
And again, the Australian experience, I remember safe sex sluts. Everywhere you went to, a nightclub or whatever, there was somebody there, usually a drag queen, going around handing out condom packs.
Yeah,
take as many as you want, free.
We did that in cruising areas in the organisation I work. We started doing that, but that was in, mid-90s or early 90s,
quite late
in the piece. There was quite a lot of police against that at the beginning. There was a lot of queer bashing as well in those places. So it was a completely different environment. I mean, there was groups like ACT UP that were very prominent. The group I work with was AIDS, which was the second NGO in the country after ACT UP. So there was some, but it wasn't coordinated like here.
So that book there, Fighting for Our Lives, Nick Cook, the author, all available at your favourite queer-friendly bookstores. You're on World Wide Wave.
Want to hear more? Find out about LGBT life in over 100 countries. Download free podcasts of this show. Subscribe to iTunes or follow us on Twitter. Visit joy.org.au/worldwidewave.
It's Romana Schlesinger from the Rainbow Pride Bratislava in Slovakia for Worldwide Wave.
Thanks, 317. Sometimes you need to be thought-provoking to challenge the status quo. I actually agree with that.
Yes,
we don't mind being prodded at all. You prod away. You have posed a question for us. Holding the Man was a brilliant Australian film that affected my generation and based on an Australian story. It's my very favourite book, actually.
Yes.
What do we think the best film about HIV is?
Well, I think for me it was Long Time Companion, which was very, when I watched it, very powerful and very,
Holding the Man, the movie, was great. Remembering the Man, which was the documentary about the whole story, was amazing as well. Jeffrey was another one from the 90s, which Patrick Stewart was in.
Oh, yes.
It was kind of a quirky, funny type thing, but, it was kind of opening up audiences to not everything being a sort of a Philadelphia sad type story.
Well, I think I was going to say Philadelphia was mainstream, really, because the HIV had more mainstream and make other... yes.
Anyway, good question there. Thanks, 317.
Very good question.
Big thank you to our guest tonight, Nick Cook, author of the book Fighting for Our Lives. It's available at Hares and Hyenas here in Melbourne, the bookshop in Sydney, or your favourite online bookstore.
Thanks to 317 for the messages and to Melina as well. And for
Melina,
the message and
your Christmas card.
The Christmas card. Thank you very much. And we will carry on.
We'll catch you next week on World Wide Wave.
Thanks for listening to another podcast from World Wide Wave, the show that takes you around the globe, one country at a time. World Wide Wave is the international news and current affairs show on Australia's LGBT radio station, Joy 94.9. You can listen live every Tuesday night from 7 p.m. Eastern Australian Time on 94.9 FM in Melbourne and online at joy.org.au. You'll find all our podcasts at joy.org.au/worldwidewave or follow us on Facebook for the latest international LGBT news. Search W3 Joy on Facebook now.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.